a monthly film screening at the Clinton Street Theater is proud to show Five Broken Cameras on Thursday, December 11th at 7 p.m. The first ever Palestinian film to be nominated for Best Documentary Feature, Five Broken Cameras is a deeply personal first-hand account of life and nonviolent resistance in a West Bank village surrounded by Israeli settlements. Shot by Palestinian farmer Ahmad Burnat, who brought his first camera in 2005 to record the birth of his youngest son, the film is structured in chapters around the destruction of each one of Burnat's cameras. Again, that's Five Broken Cameras, Thursday, December 11th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Triangle Productions run of Five Lesbians Eating Quiche, starting November 28th and ending on December 20th at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza in Portland. This is a comedic look at the window of 1956's Susan B. Anthony Society for the Sisters of Gertrude Stein, as they sit in their renovated community center, sharing secrets as the threat of atomic apocalypse nibbles at their heels. Again, that's the Triangle Productions performance of Five Lesbians Eating Quiche at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This Health and Healthcare Forum is the second one from the 2014 Oregon Public Health Association Conference. First is a conversation with Dr. Margarita Alegria about her keynote address, which was titled, What We Can Learn to Do to Eliminate Disparities in Healthcare. Next, three Portlanders will tell us about a lively and innovative health intervention in Old Town Chinatown. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
It was quite an interesting talk having to do with what causes health disparities between various groups and in neighborhoods. And we often think in this country that it's money because, of course, readers of books like The Spirit Level are very aware that the U.S. has increasing disparities in income and that causes a lot of social problems, but a lot of them are health related. Taking a public health approach is what you ended up advocating. Do you want to describe what a public health approach would entail?
Sure. I think a public health approach entails not really thinking on a one-to-one, which is the way I think healthcare has been thinking about things, but actually taking more of a population health approach where you are actually looking at neighborhoods and trying to understand what has happened in those neighborhoods that puts people in a disadvantage and makes them ill. And so when you start thinking about more of a neighborhood, more of a local thing, rather than a one-to-one, is this patient that has this illness, but rather not, you look in the aggregate. But more than in the aggregate, you're really trying to understand what explains the profile of that locale. What is it? Why are some locales that you find so healthy and others so sick? And what are the toxic mechanisms that can explain those differences?
I should have already mentioned that you're mostly concerned with mental health and substance abuse. And I should mention that you are in the Department of
Psychiatry. I was trained as a psychologist, but I'm in the Department of Psychiatry at Harvard Medical School.
This is the area within which you've been focusing in your research, and let's go over that a little bit. You're a native of Puerto Rico. You were born there?
Right. I was born there. I went to college in the United States. I lived in Puerto Rico for quite a long time, and then since 2002, I've been living in Massachusetts. And, you know, I started in Puerto Rico doing work studying the mental health of the poor. I was very interested in trying to understand the mental health of the poor. And actually, I was very surprised because I was finding that poverty was not necessarily, we study poverty and study poverty in Puerto Rico, but study poverty in New York. And found that being poor in New York had more impact that being poor in Puerto Rico. So it was an interesting way of trying to see where the differences in health coming from. And we're finding less and less impact of income, I have to say, in mental health. We're actually finding a bigger impact of other issues that are tied to, like, how do you perceive your social status, what we call social position, as being a more important aspect than actually your income per se. I think social position might be a bigger marker that impacts your mental health than actually your actual income level, because how we adjudicate social status is very different. So certain ethnic racial groups of the population actually give different characteristics of themselves as having more status than others, than having social relationships for certain groups might be more important than for others, or having education might be more important for certain groups than others, or having beauty. So social status, I think, is a very important marker.
So would that depend on what that particular cultural group values or sees as the usual or the normal or abnormal?
Exactly. I think when you are very different, I think people might attribute to you something less self-worth and might treat you differently, and that gets recognized very quickly in people. And that's where I think if you have other things that help you sort of buffer that effect. Let me give you an example. I think sometimes coming from being a majority, where you've developed your identity as a majority, is very helpful, because you don't even think about people treating you badly because something you are. But if you come and then start getting treated very differently, that might have an impact, in especially if you're young. That's very different. So I think that how you think of yourself in relationship to how other people treat you and how you then build that social position, I think is quite important.
Difficult to treat, in a sense, isn't it? It's difficult to work on.
But I think in Oregon, one thing that has impressed me, Oregon has been very receptive to people, immigrants coming from the outside, and very, very inclusive. And I think that shows you have very low rates of how Hispanics or Latinos actually report their mental health. It's actually quite good compared to the other groups. And I think that that might be that inclusive reception that they get and how that makes you feel like you're part of it. You're not different. You're not the other.
That's very interesting. Well, we do have still a lot of issues around immigration. It's interesting to see that you have a positive impression. Now, of course, your background is Puerto Rican, and our people here tend to come mainly from Mexico, I think, but also from Central American countries. I just wonder if individuals from these very different parts of the Spanish-speaking world, how they relate to each other, if there's any problem there, or have they come to recognize each other as people with a common background?
A great question, because it really depends on what part of the United States you ask that question. So in certain areas, there's a lot of intergroup conflict, even between minorities, because they put them at odds one to the other, which I think it's a very tragic situation, because again, as you can see from my talk today, if anything, I think we should be more multicultural, we should be more inclusive, we could learn a lot from different groups. But I do think there is a lot of intercultural conflict between certain groups. But again, that's another good example of how you see in certain neighborhoods, but it is horrendous. I mean, a good example would be between Dominicans and Puerto Ricans. Sometimes there's been a lot of fights about who has the power. In the same way I was talking today about disparities could also be for whites.
Right.
And in certain environments, I'm sure they feel that there's prejudice and bias and discrimination against them, and that they are being treated differently. And so that's exactly my point. I think that that's where we should focus.
Being a minority is always tricky. I found myself once, I was part-time librarian at a Catholic school of nursing back in the old days when they had them in hospitals. I was the only one who was not Catholic, who was not a nurse. I didn't have much conversation with many other people, except one lovely retired nun who helped out from time to time and told me some very interesting things about her upbringing in Central Europe. I felt for a while that I was always in situations where I was the minority, and I realized this isn't comfortable.
Exactly. I couldn't agree more. I think being a minority it's very difficult. It really is very difficult. And then not only being it, but how people treat you.
You started out talking about research with doctor's offices and the first encounters with a particular patient and some very interesting studies about having actors portray certain illness symptoms, identical ones, but people who look a lot different and, of course, were acting in different behavioral patterns. I'm sure they were very good at presenting almost a stereotype, perhaps, of an individual that they were portraying, and then having actual physicians review those and diagnose them. And that was very interesting. So what were the lessons from that, and how did that lead you to broader conclusions and ones that you told the audience today that they might find rather controversial?
Well, I think first let me state that study was the Shulman study, the very famous study done by Shulman, which is the one that I was presenting. And there have been several studies after that done where they've actually done either brought standardized patients to different offices and see how they get treated differently. There's a more recent study that's going to come out pretty soon. It's a study where they actually called offices and left voice messages and actually changed the voice of the person to be either middle class or working class, and then also changed the voice to be white or black, and used different voices. And they found that returns of people returning back the appointment were very different. So for example, for black men, the rates were very low. So it just tells you how we make judgments of people on both physical and even voice attributes, everything. It's a natural phenomenon. The study I was discussing in today's talk was a study where we videotaped the first appointments to a psychologist, psychiatrist, or any mental health worker. And it was very interesting to see how people made determinations so quickly, on the first couple of minutes, and how they decided on certain things. So for example, how they decided on what sort of questions they were going to ask versus others. And people say they use a lot of intuition, but actually intuition very much depends on how you are assessing the other. One of the things we're trying to teach providers so that they make a better connection independently if they like or dislike the person, because it happens very quickly, is what we call cognitive empathy. So cognitive empathy is, we know that the more you get to know a person, the less likely you tend to be putting attributions on them that are not correct. So being curious and trying what the other aspect that we talked is called perspective taking, which is trying to really be curious and get to think, like, how does that person think? How does that person feel? What really matters to them? There are ways in which you can actually develop what's called cognitive empathy.
So can that be taught?
I'm hoping it can. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what we're testing. Can we teach people how to do it? It could be a great opportunity for trying to do more cross-cultural interactions where people not necessarily know the other, but you don't make attributions that quickly. Rather than thinking, well, this person is Asian or is African-American, you start thinking about them from the perspective, let me try to see how I can connect with this person, and let me try to see, is there a way that in being curious, in being interested, and learning how that person might feel or think, I can try to establish some bond.
Rather than the stereotyping approach.
I have to say I've been guilty of that to myself. I think that that's actually not the way to go, that it shouldn't be on ethnicity or race. Because even within certain cultures, people can be very different. And the more you try to understand the person from a unique perspective, and that's what we're trying to see if we can teach providers to do. I mean, first we want to try to find out, will it work? But second, if it works, can we teach it to other groups? Because it should be part of like schools, where we teach children the importance of connecting with others without making judgments on them so quickly because of their appearance.
Now, you mentioned at the outset that you were going to challenge people a little bit and have some controversial statements. What did you think was the most controversial concept?
Well, I think that the controversial aspect is I think people always think of minorities as people of color. But what I wanted to try to bring forth is in this country, because things are changing so rapidly and we're having all these populations be part of the U.S., I think it's going to be a different phenomenon. Because I think if you're white, but I'm a minority, you might experience people reacting to you very differently than if you're white and you've been living in a mainly white community. And I think it's just that aspect of thinking not so much of disparities as something that affects people of color, but mostly affects people that are placed in a minority situation.
And that could be your background, your training, your neighborhood, your language, of course.
Exactly.
It could be religion. Well, that wasn't what I was thinking of.
Oh, interesting.
What I was thinking of was that you stressed that healthcare itself is not the crucial thing to focus on at this time. And I should mention that our governor, Kitzhaber, who was an emergency room doctor before he went into politics, he has said that over and over, it's the environment.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that was the second controversial thing that I knew I was saying. I thought the second one was don't focus on the healthcare. I think that's where we're putting all our money, and I'm thinking not so good. And I'm in a department of psychiatry, and I work in a hospital, so you can imagine how controversial that is. But I think healthcare can only do so much. I mean, don't get me wrong, I do believe people should have access to healthcare. I'm very much in favor of that, and people should be treated for what they have. But I also think a very important aspect is to not put all our monies into healthcare at the sacrifice of leaving other things like the environment and the neighborhoods. I think we've depleted public health for many years now, taking away some of the things because people were putting so much money into healthcare. But I actually think we need to rebuild public health. I think if you are really trying to improve health status, then healthcare should be your last resort, and you should be investing in other things higher in the stream. I mean, I also think if you live in an environment where you're exposed to violence constantly, where you doubt the people you're seeing around, you're raising a very different frame of mind that if you lived in an environment where people are, you know, very inclusive, you can trust on them, you can relate to them. So I think that that's the opportunity we have. I mean, I know it sounds like, what is she talking about, building trust, but what if we tested that intervention? If we tested building trust in our communities and having people interact more and feeling more like they're closer to each other and can relate more and lower the exposure to violence, the exposure to risk, we could test that in the same way we've tested so many healthcare things. We could test that and then try to see if that increases health. Can we see people getting better in terms of health?
An inspiring talk, and it's good to have you here in Oregon.
Thank you so much.
I'm talking to a group of people who are working on a special project, and I'd like them to introduce themselves. On my left, and Helen, you want to start?
Yeah. Hi, Bobby. I'm Helen Ying, and I am the chair for SNAP, which stands for Safe Nightlife Advocacy Partnership. We also have it now expanded to a new name, which is Safe Neighborhood Advocacy Partnership. Next to me, we have a staff of Multnomah County, actually, who is the most brilliant young woman in town, is spearheading this effort for the coalition.
I'm blushing. So I'm Sandra Storm, and I'm with Multnomah County, and I coordinate SNAP, which is the coalition that Helen is a chair of, and SNAP stands for, like Helen said, Safe Nightlife Advocacy Partnership. It's a project to reduce high-risk drinking among young adults in Multnomah County, and we've expanded recently to address underage drinking and underage marijuana use as well.
My name is Mireille Lafont, and I'm with the county. As Sandra is saying, as part of that expansion, I was hired as the school liaison to look at underage drinking and youth before they get to the 18 to 25-year-old range.
Wonderful to talk to you all. So how long has this group been functioning?
Well, I think we started about 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. That's when I met Sandra. It's just been, the momentum has been so tremendous. You know, we started from a group of volunteers, you know, looking at how do we do this work. We came up with a frame of reference with three different initiatives as being the primary focus, and I will let Sandra explain what they are.
Just before we do that, could you tell me a little bit about what prompted this? Why did it seem necessary to do this?
Sure. Our project was actually instigated as kind of part of a larger statewide effort. So the state of Oregon received a grant to really do a thorough assessment of the state and to identify a priority substance abuse issue. And so after the state conducted an assessment looking at, you know, substance abuse rates and looking at long-term health outcomes and looking at crime rates and looking at a variety of factors, they identified that high-risk drinking among the young adult population was really a big issue in Oregon. We had higher rates, binge drinking rates and heavy drinking rates among both women and men, and especially in this young adult population. And associated with that, we had significantly higher rates of alcohol-related chronic disease, so liver disease and heart disease that are associated with alcohol consumption, as well as the direct impact in terms of crime and sexual violence and other issues associated with high-risk drinking. So when the state conducted that assessment, they also identified some counties to focus on, and Multnomah County was one of them.
And Mireille, could you tell us about the school and why those particular schools, or were there observations of problems?
Well, as far as the school, there hasn't been a lot of research, and that's why we want to be there. We want to kind of do an assessment, and there aren't very many safeties in place, and we want to go ahead and set up a program. And also so we can kind of provide a transition to the college-age students where we're looking at that 18 to 25-year-old group.
And then we duplicated the process in Multnomah County. So once we got that grant at the county, we have a lot of support in terms of a framework like Helen was referring to. So there are key things that years of research around substance abuse prevention have produced, things that we want to look for in the community. We'll often refer to them as risk factors or protective factors. So the goal is to understand what are the risk factors in our community that are going to put individuals more at risk to engage in risky drinking, or what are the factors in the community that are going to help protect them. And so as a group, we started to form a coalition and really do this assessment to understand what are the risk factors and what are the protective factors and how do we address those risk factors and build the protective factors. In Multnomah County, because there was a lot happening around the kind of the nightlife scene in Old Town Chinatown, there were a lot of concerns that were arising. So when I was out in the community doing the assessment, there was this coalescence around the need to do something about high-risk drinking in around the nightclubs in Portland. So that's really where we started.
So are young people going to the nightclubs? Underage sneaking in, is that right?
Well, there is an issue with underage people sneaking in, but there's also just a large number. So we've heard about 8,000 people on a busy Saturday night will come down to this district. And anytime you have 8,000 people in one place, you're going to have a certain percentage of people who are over consuming and who are, you know, getting into trouble in a number of ways. And so our goal in our work there is really, again, to build up those protective factors to try to reduce the number of people that are getting into risky situations.
Well, Helen, can you talk about what some of the protective factors might be?
So one of the things that we are actually so excited is because in the coalition, we have members that are bar owners, and they're connecting us to work with people who are like the important people who actually serve these young people when they come out to patronize these bars. So we're actually offering a bar academy on December 1st. And we're reaching out to, of course, all the bars in Old Town Chinatown, but we're going beyond those boundaries. We're reaching out to other bars in the Portland area, inviting them to come. We're targeting to invite 200 people to come. And in this bar academy, we're going to have three tracks. One is aimed at the owners, one is aimed at the security people, and one is aimed at the servers. So at three different levels, we will bring in people to present practices that are going to help them to reduce harm. That is really the underlying message. We're not saying don't come and have fun. Come and have fun, but don't get wasted, you know, don't get hurt from that experience.
I can remember that we used to think, and I did a postdoc on this in the early 80s in Hartford, Connecticut. One of the focus was on how you set up a bar. And when I came back home, I had a class here. I was an anthropologist that dealt with health a lot. And one of the assignments was for students to go out and observe and write about a place that served alcohol and what the music was like, what the color in the atmosphere was like, what darkness or lightness it was. The feeling was that that's the control. If you want to have a bar where people beat each other up, you can do that. Just certain kind of music, et cetera, et cetera. If you want to have one that doesn't have those attributes, you can do that. What memories it brings back.
Yeah, totally.
And that's the kind of thing that we're looking at. You know, it's about the environment. So we're hoping to really help build an environment down there that encourages people to come and have a good time and do lots of different activities, you know, not just drinking, dancing, theater, all the different kinds of entertainment that people can do. And a lot of that is, what is the experience like when you're down there? What's the message that they're getting from the environment in terms of how they should behave? That's some of the focus of our work. Like Helen was talking about, we are definitely focused on the education, educating servers and building their skills that way. We're also looking at policy in terms of helping build that environment and having consistent policy around licensure and enforcing over service, but also just the more general norm. What's it like to walk through the neighborhood? What does it feel like?
Are you going to look at the music that's sometimes there and whether there's space for dancing?
There was a dance event in Old Town Chinatown that was through a project called Elevate that was just music played out in the street and people performing and dancing together, and it was pretty cool. So we'd like to see events like that where people are engaged in building community and not necessarily dependent always on alcohol. You know, having a good time is fine too, and responsible consumption is fine as well. But it's great to have alternative activities for people who maybe want to get together and not drink.
And where does the school come in?
The school, I think we're trying to set a norm of what is appropriate behavior, looking at, you know, what's appropriate for the student, their parents, and we're basically focusing on four schools in the central precinct and hoping to expand. So we have Lincoln, Cleveland, Wilson, and Benson high schools.
Very interesting. Well, this sounds like a really fun project, too, and you can...
And it's very rewarding.
Very rewarding, yeah.
And it's very diverse. I mean, our coalition has a lot of members, and it's very diverse. We have health professionals, we have law enforcement agents, we have educators.
We have OLCC represented as well,
yeah. Yeah. Neighborhood folks, public health.
Parents among those neighborhood folks.
Yeah. Like Mireille was saying, we're really trying to expand to include youth, to include schools, and some of those youth-serving organizations as we look at addressing some of the issues specific to underage drinking.
Keynote speaker this morning talked a lot about environment as a very important part of creating a situation where healthy people flourish.
Yeah, and so to kind of sum it up, Bobby, it is like, you know, I was at a training last year and someone in the audience of the training said, well, this strategy is like looking at cleaning the pond instead of cleaning one duck at a time.
good luck with your ducks. I hope they're all in a row. Thank you.
Thank you.
We've just been talking with Helen Ying, Sandra Storm, and Mireille Lafont about their project with young adults in downtown Portland. In this, the second program from the 2014 Public Health Association Conference, we also spoke with keynote speaker Dr. Margarita Alegria. The Health and Healthcare Forum is produced by Roberta Hall. Theme music was composed by Laurie Childers and played by Laurie Childers and Kent White.
And it is just a few seconds before 12 noon on KBOO Portland. Coming up next is the noontime jamboree, so don't go anywhere. Well, we're going to listen to the noon headlines before the jamboree, but go stay here.
Now for the KBOO News at Noon for Monday, December 8th, 2014. Graduate assistants at University of Oregon continued their strike today after failing to reach an agreement with school officials in meetings last week. The 1,500 teaching assistants are on strike to protest the school's medical and maternity leave policies. The strikers are asking U of O for 2 weeks of paid medical and maternity leave a year. The school has instead offered a fund from which all graduate assistants, including those not represented by the union, could draw $1,000 to $1,500 at a time. Graduate assistants are particularly important at this time of year when the culmination of the term and final exams require a large amount of grading and exam proctoring. In response to the strike, some exams have been shortened, while some students have been given the option to opt out of their finals. Volunteers, non-union assistants, and faculty are helping proctor and grade the remaining exams. The local Teamsters chapter has said it will not pick up garbage at University of Oregon in support of the strikers. A U.S. senator from Oregon has introduced legislation to block an FBI request to make tapping tech devices easier. Earlier this year, FBI Director James Comey proposed the creation of legislation that would require wiretap access for smartphones. Last week, Oregon Democrat Ron Wyden introduced legislation to block this. His Secure Data Act would ban government mandates to make tech